Guns N' Roses the other day was looking for a drummer. My friend texted me. He's like, I got to get you in there. At the time we reached out, they already
announced
it.
How do you build an agency?
I mean, an interview with someone plays and they said, are you an agent? I just said, yes.
You had to convince the most attractive people in the world that you should represent them. And then you have to go out.
Company had worked with people like Gal Gadot, who represented Jennifer Lawrence.
Scott Lipp's top five drummers for you.
Today's episode is sponsored by Gator Cases. Guitarists, like any other musician, value the advantages of proper protection for their gear. Guitars, amps, effects, and accessories all need safe transport and storage. Luckily, Gator's got you covered.
Scott Lipp's on the podcast. This is very meta because I feel like we're in your unofficial set right here.
Sort of.
It's tough to interview a podcaster because there's a lot of content you have to go through. Like, you put out so much content.
Thank you.
Where it's like, who is Scott? In order to figure out, you have to go through hundreds of hours of interviews.
I hope you didn't, but I appreciate you doing it if you did. And I appreciate being here, Zach. I've never really sat on this side, so I like
Well, this
it.
Is going to be fun. I listened to every lip service interview in preparation for this.
Just spent the last, 8 years doing this? Or there's, 300 episodes?
No. I didn't do that. Okay. But there's a lot. Scott, in a New York Times interview, Tommy Hilfiger said in a quote, I have the quote here, there are men about town who are pretty annoying and self-promoting. That is not Scott. That is what he said in New York Times interview.
I gave Tommy $30 for saying that. But actually, I love Tommy. I have so many funny stories about him, Zach, if you want to hear any of them.
Yeah. Well, hold on. I do. How do you balance that, though? How do you balance being the man about town without being annoying or self-promoting?
You know, I think it's important. I mean, as you know, because you have a show, too, and as the show grows, I think it's really important to stay humble. And I always try and stay humble. I mean, sometimes, you know, some years ago, I got to play with Courtney Love in front of whatever, 20,000 people, and I come off stage and I still had the same problems that I had before the gig. So it's so important, I think, just to remember where you come from. And, you know, people see you on the way up and the way down, and whatever I've experienced in life, it's always about just staying true. And yeah, I mean, you know, thank you for Tommy. I don't even remember that quote, but thankfully I'm not annoying and I appreciate him saying that. So.
Sometimes, though, I have played massive gigs and I've come off stage actually feeling better about myself and my life choices. And I go, you know what? Everything I've done in my life to be a musician, whatever, it was all worth it because I got to play that gig. And I do feel like sometimes I've come off gigs and some of my problems have gone away. You didn't feel that way?
I still got to walk my dog at 1 a.m. or he pees in the house.
But
or
that inner voice, that inner voice that goes, what have I done in my life to become a musician? Did that go away a little bit?
A little bit. I mean, we'll talk about it in a moment, but you know, I have a business still. So I would be on tour and I would still have the same, people would be calling me like, hey, where are you? And I'm like, I'm in Louisiana. What do you mean? When are you coming back? I'm like, in 2 weeks, we need you now. It's like, your problems don't necessarily go away. As I said, your dog could go to the bathroom in your house and you're still dealing with all these things and the minutiae of life. But it's great that 1 hour you're on stage is what they say. You have 23 hours to do whatever, but the 1 hour on stage is really what matters. But it was always about occupying my time, those other 23 hours on tour, because I would get up in the morning, I'd go on one of those tourist buses and take a tour around New Orleans or wherever, Austin, wherever. The other guys in my band would wake up at 3 a.m. Where were you? I'm like, I've been out on a tour bus the last 2 hours seeing the city. And I love to be busy. So I would constantly do things. But, you know, a lot of people on tour, they just don't know what to do themselves.
Was there any sense when you were building your agency and when you were doing all these things that took you away from music? Did you ever have this feeling like, oh, this is a great opportunity, but this is going to take me further away from what I actually want to do, which maybe is playing drums?
Yeah, I mean, I always wanted to play drums. I mean, I always say now, though, if I only play drums, I'd probably live at my parents' house, you know, because it's sort of like to be a rock drummer now, it's not easy. When I first joined Courtney's band, again, you know, I got paid, but it wasn't like, you know, you're not getting rich playing drums in bands these days unless you write the songs or you're the manager. And a lot of drummers, as I speak a lot on my show, become the managers or the agents, or they end up getting involved with the bands because a lot of times you aren't the songwriter. So, I would love to just play drums. But again, Guns N' Roses the other day was looking for a drummer. My friend texted me. He's like, I got to get you in there. I was like, that'd be great. By the time we reached out to them, I think they already found someone.
Yeah.
Literally, it happened that day. And I saw the text between Slash and friend of mine who used to manage my band, who was texting him. He's like, yeah, it's already being announced.
Feel like you would have the chops now to go into that band, or would you lock yourself away for a month and learn those tunes?
There's no way I could compete with my buddy Matt Sorum, who was in that band for years. I'd have to lock myself away in Woodshed for 2 months.
Yeah.
And even when my friend said, he's like, do you want to audition for Guns N' Roses? I'm like, I do, but I'm not ready right this second. I mean, I do all these other things now. So
yeah. Okay, tell me the Tommy Hilfiger story.
Yeah, it's just funny. I mean, from someone that's doing a podcast yourself, you know, I mean, I'm not sure if you were doing it during the pandemic, were you?
Yes, I was, yeah.
Okay, so during the pandemic, we were all like scrambling, trying to figure it out. I don't really love the Zoom podcast because I feel like this is always better. So when you asked me to do this, I was like, is it in person? You know, it's like, it's always better. I don't know, you can connect
with
someone.
It's way better, yeah.
I hate Zooms. I mean, it's so impersonal. So I ended up doing a bunch because I wanted to keep the show going. But, you know, you kind of had the hustle and, you know, people are like, oh, it's a Zoom. And no one's that excited about it, but everybody wanted to stay busy. So I got on the Zoom with his like assistant or publicist during the Zoom. We were going to do an interview together, and Tommy's very gracious. I think he's running like still like the figurehead of a $6 billion company. So we do the Zoom, and again, I like to go through people's journeys. It's their life stories, and I think we spent like an hour and a half on the phone. It was a long podcast about his whole entire life story, and I don't know how often you use Zoom, but at the end of the Zoom, when you're done recording, it sends you this email. So I'm waiting for the email, and it's like 3 minutes. The email doesn't come through. I'm like, okay, it was an hour and a half. Don't panic. It's probably coming through, and 8 minutes go by. I still don't get the email. I'm like, oh my God, what the fuck happened? You know, by the way, I left out a part of the story. I had text Tommy in the beginning and I said, hey, we're on the Zoom. He's like, I can't figure out how to get on. So I was like, all right, I guess I'll leave the Zoom and come back on. So I left that part out.
We're recording.
So an hour goes by. I'm sweating at this point, right? I still don't have the file. I'm like, how the fuck am I going to tell him that I don't have it? So I keep hoping it's like a glitch. And if you've ever like tried to contact Zoom, it's like trying to contact like the government. No one answers the phone. It's all automated. It's like an AI thing. It's like, sorry, we're not available this time, but call back later. I'm like, that's not helping me. I don't have the file. So, yeah, I mean, I never got the file. I never press record. You know, I think when we went in and out of the Zoom, something happened. We were recording. And then when we came back in, it wasn't recording. And I didn't have the nerve to tell him. He told me his whole life story. And again, he's running like an empire. So I hit his publicist up. I'm like, hey, I don't even know how to tell you this. I don't think that it recorded, you know, and I don't know how to tell Tommy. He's such a good dude. You know, she ended up telling me, he's like, I'll do it again with Scott. That's my Tommy Hilfiger.
And he did it again.
He did it again. And I have other stories about him like that. But you know.
Well, I did this sort of, this almost happened to me one time. I did a massive interview with someone who was so generous to do it. And I thought I lost the file. I ended up not losing it, but I thought I lost it in a hard drive. And I was ready to tell him I got mugged. And that's how I lost the file. I was like, what am I going to say to get out of this? So that's the interview that you had with him. The second time.
And one other, just sorry, this is not Tommy Hilfiger story, but another one of my favorite stories about Tommy. I played in a band for a little bit with his brothers. So Annie Hilfiger plays bass. His other brother, Michael H., sings. They're like adopted brother of the family. And we used to play around town, and occasionally we'd have Steve Conte, who plays with like the New York Dolls, and who played with the New York Dolls, and Michael Monroe in the band, and Sam Yoffer plays with Michael Monroe, and Frank that played in Guns N' Roses. He had all these like interchangeable members, and it was all guys in bands that did pretty well. And we played at Don Hills many years ago. And so at one point, Tommy was in the audience and he wanted to get on stage and play with us at Don Hills. So he jumps on stage. We're playing a Stones track. I don't remember what track
it was.
What
does he play?
He plays guitar. Packed house, 250 people. At the end of the show, I said to Andy, his brother, it's so weird. You know, I'm playing drums, but I can't really hear Tommy in my monitor. Like I couldn't hear him at all. He's like, I'll let you know a little secret. I said, what? He said, he wasn't plugged in. I said, he was air guitaring. Like, what the fuck? But, you know, that's Tommy.
Who should call him out at?
Obviously now people will hear it. But, you know, he's great. He's amazing. And just, he's that kind of guy, you know, lives life to the fullest. And, I mean, I couldn't do that. But, you know, clearly he could do whatever he wants and does well at it. So
when you moved to L.A. in, I guess, the 80s, and you were playing in the Sunset Strip, like, you were in these bands that were around the guys in Guns N' Roses. Your band was Black Cherry.
Correct.
Right? So did you think, how close did you feel like you were going to make it?
It's funny you said that, Zach, because the guys in Guns N' Roses used to actually come on stage and play in my band. Like Izzy and Duff would jump on stage with us and we'd play a track like Star Star, the Stones track. And Guns N' Roses, there was kind of two camps in LA. There was like the Jane's Addiction camp and a place called The Scream. And sort of this underground, you know, James was on, I think, Triple X Records. And there was an underground movement of all these bands that were like Tex and the Horseheads and Jane's Addiction, some bands that made it like James. And then there was the, you know, Sunset Strip stuff of like Poison and earlier than that, Motley and Rad and a lot of the like hair bands, although I don't consider Motley really a hair band. And then there was Guns N' Roses, who sat somewhere in between. So my band was more of the Jane's Addiction, Guns N' Roses thing. unfortunately, all the guys in my band, or a lot of the guys in my band, were like on major drugs. I was a kid from Long Island, from the Five Towns. I never did drugs. I didn't know what heroin was. I didn't know what was going on, but I always
but
knew that.
Is it crazy that you didn't fall into that, or that you weren't in an influence? Because I've never really done drugs either, and I've always go, why? Like, because I've been around so much of it, but never got into it.
No,
ever.
I mean, you started to see a lot of guys in that scene die around that period, and it wasn't interesting to me. I always worked really hard. My parents really trusted me moving out to L.A. in, like, 1987, going to music school, living right off of Hollywood Boulevard, where there were a bunch of crackheads and hookers and whatever living like on my doorstep. And I don't think they were thrilled. I think initially I told my dad I wanted to go to PIT. He's like, amazing. You want to be a scientist? The Pittsburgh Institute of Technology? I'm like, no, I want to go to drumming school. It's the Percussion Institute of Technology. It's GIT and PIT. That's not what they had in mind for me. But they were supportive nonetheless. And I mean, we were part of that. My singer was in LA Guns, one of the two bands that became Guns N' Roses. We would play with Guns N' Roses. We opened up for them. Played a lot with bands like James Addiction. That was my first show ever in Hollywood. I did think that. But Paul Black, my singer, he was in LA Guns, got kicked out, had to sue the record label to get his royalties from writing the songs. And when you're suing a record label and trying to record with a subsidiary of that record label, they don't really like it. And so we never really went that far because of that. And I think a lot of labels were not interested in the fact that he was suing another, I think it was PolyGram at the time. And so, yeah, we were one step away. We were one of the bigger bands out there. But, you know, that led me to play with a guy named Marty Fredrickson, who was a big songwriter at the time. I eventually played with the guys in Steel Panther in a band called the Boogie Nights, which was a disco band, weirdly enough. Steel Panther is still a pretty big rock band, even though it's sort of like a farce of being in a band. They're still playing like the O2 Arena in London, which is crazy.
Amazing player. Satchel is an incredible guitar player on any level.
And we played in a disco band together. There was like a guy that created like 8 versions of this disco band. It was all guys in rock bands that couldn't make money that needed to play disco to make money. How ironic, right?
Yeah.
And he created this empire of like all these players that would play, you know, Saturday Night Fever to I Will Survive. And we all wore like the John Travolta wig, or some guys wore like Afro wigs, and I don't know if we could do it today, but the band did well. And we all got paid, and that was something I never really experienced playing rock music.
So what's the story? Because now I guess the band's broken up, and now you're like, I'm in L.A., what the hell do I do? And your mom says, I guess your cousin or some relative had a modeling agency.
Yeah, I really didn't know who models were. I knew who Cindy Crawford was or Naomi Campbell, but my mother said, yeah, you know, why don't you go get it? I think your cousin owns some agency. You can, you know, if you're...
Next models.
I had hurt my arm playing drums in this disco band, the Boogie Nights, and couldn't play drums. And so I just figured I'd do it for a month or something. I started driving people around, like pre-Ubers. I was the guy that drove people around to castings and things like that. My cousin said to me at some point, you know, I'll pay you gas money. And eventually I got into it, and I was like, I'd love to combine film and music and, you know, all the things I love, maybe endorsements. I wasn't so into like modeling business, but the entertainment business was really attractive to me because I managed some of the bands I was in early on. And so that felt pretty organic to me. And so, yeah, early on, I started working with a lot of these iconic, talented individuals, and eventually working with a lot of celebrities. I think I was like A$AP Rocky's first fashion agent ever, and I kind of helped build up his fashion profile. And now I do a lot of just endorsements for a lot of big names. Work a lot with brands, but obviously I do the podcast. Every blue moon, I play drums here and there with Courtney Love. We haven't played for like 5 years, but the last gig she did, I played with her. I got to tour with Lana Del Rey with her, which was incredible. So I do a bunch of things. I mean, these days it's not weird to diversify. It used to be you had one job. Like when I was growing up, you did one thing. I'm so creative, I need to do more than one thing just to have an outlet. And being a musician, I think it's normal to, I mean, again, bands used to have like, they had members that wouldn't have other bands. Now it's pretty common. I mean, I don't know how many side bands are on certain, you know, certain artists have like 50 bands, right?
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know, Maynard from Tool was on my show. He's got like 7 bands. I mean, I'm exaggerating. I think he has 3 or 4, right? But he's in a huge band, but he still has like 3 other bands, whatever it is, right? 2, like a Perfect Circle and Pucifer, but like, I'm sure he's got other stuff going on that's brewing, right? And he's got like 1 massive band, 2 other pretty big bands. So that wasn't the case years ago, but these days, like people just, they need to diversify.
What's the relationship when you're working with an artist as their fashion manager and they might have a manager managing their music career or whatever it is? What does that relationship look like?
Yeah, it's always a bit, it can be a bit touchy, but I'm a team player. So at the end of the day, like I'm just bringing opportunities to people. So I like to be very friendly with people's other teammates. Now that day is like people don't have one person to go to, right? You have like the cousin pitching you, or the mother, the brother, the uncle, and then they've got the publicist, the manager, the agent, someone like me. So it used to be there was like one way to get to a person. Now with DM, people can get to people for brand deals all the time. And now with AI, I have to say, like, the agency business is going to, it could be possibly defunct in 10 years, maybe 5 years. There's an article that came out the other day about H&M using like all these AI models. And actually, it's happening. I was working on something like this about a year ago. Whether we like it or not, it's already happening. The landscape is changing. So I think you just have to be ahead of the curve. I was the first one, I think, or one of the first people in my industry to work with influencers. And celebrities in my little part of the world. So again, you just have to try and be ahead of the curve.
I was watching some episodes of your—
All of them, you said.
I was watching your reality show Scouted in preparation for this because I was so fascinated.
Really did a deep dive.
This is a totally different world. My big takeaway was it seemed like on the show, I was like, one management, the offices were massive.
Yeah.
How did you go from your cousins, you know, driving people around, cold calling photographers, you know, you were fearless. How did you then build the office and get everyone in? Like how do you build an agency like that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I guess they say fake it till you make it in Hollywood, right? I was a driver. I drove people around. I ended up bringing in a lot of talent to my relative's company. And then one day, I think they wanted me to get more experience and come back, which essentially sounded like firing me.
Yeah.
So I was like, all right, I'm going to go out there and try and become an agent. And I remember having an interview with someone place and they said, are you an agent? I just said, yes. I didn't really know what I was doing, but I'm sure I'm not the first person like in Hollywood that kind of said they knew a little bit more than they did. I was probably a year into the business. It was probably 1997, 98. And I was working in a division with some other people and they started quitting. And then all of a sudden I was the only one there and I really didn't know what I was doing. And, you know, a guy across the table from me would say like, hey, Scotty, call Helmut Newton. He's in town. Meanwhile, I didn't know that that was the biggest fashion photographer in the world.
Yeah, right.
And you didn't call him. It was like calling Steven Spielberg if you're an actor.
You know,
someone says, you know, I'm an actor. I got Spielberg's number. Just call him. I didn't know. So I was like, I'm a drummer. If he doesn't like me, he can hang up the phone on me. If he doesn't want to talk to me, what's the worst thing that can happen to me? So I would call his hotel, try and get him to see some people for me on like go-sees, that's what they were called. And he'd hang up the phone to me. I'd keep calling back. And later on, I read a book called The Mailroom that interviewed Ari Emanuel or talked about a lot of the people that ran Hollywood. And they kind of said that you had to have no fear and you had to really put it out there and work hard and hustle. And if you had no fear, that was the only way to get ahead in Hollywood because, you know, it was so hard and everybody started in the mailroom at those agencies. And so I kind of did that. I just figured, you know what? I'm a creative person. I'm not coming from that world. And I don't even know if I'm going to stay in it. Maybe I'll be in it for a year. I'm calling people that are photographers. I mean, they're nice people. I'm sure I would hope that they were nice, but at the end of the day, if they don't like me, so be it, right? And that's how I did it. I just started really hustling. I think hard work was really kind of the key to all everything I was doing because ultimately I didn't really sleep and I worked so hard for many years.
So your role was you had to convince the most attractive people in the world that you should represent them, and then you have to go out and you have to get brands or clothing companies or whatever to convince them to work with the people that you're representing and manage all this in the middle. So how are you, like some of these brands are a nightmare to get in touch with or some of these fashion lines or whatever. So were you just calling everyone and that was it? Like how'd you break in?
It's probably no different than, I mean, it's not actually that much different than managing any other artist, right? You're just managing personalities and that's tricky in itself as you probably might know, right? So you're managing personalities and, you know, the brand business is such a huge business these days. The influencer business, I don't know lately, but, you know, a couple years ago it was a multi-billion dollar business. I'm assuming it still is, maybe a little bit down from where it used to be. But you're managing personalities. You know, I work with so many great people. When A$AP Rocky first walked into my office, like, he didn't really have a lot going on. He had a single that was going to come out. And we just started working together. The kid is so charismatic. He smiles. He lights up a room. I didn't know that he was going to become the legendary artist that he was. And I got him like a Italian Vogue cover within like a couple months of working with him because I started putting him out there and hustling and putting him on my Instagram before people were doing that kind of thing. And people would see him and someone called me and said, hey, we had a shoot canceled. The band Phoenix doesn't wear the clothes. They don't want to wear the clothes on the cover of this Italian Vogue shoot. You have this like A$AP Rocky guy. Can you get him down to the studio? I said, now? Like, what do you mean? And he was doing, a video shoot at that time with Skrillex. I got him to the studio and a couple months later, this cover came out and all of a sudden, like, everything exploded. So a lot of it, look, it's preparation, it's luck, it's hard work, it's so many things, right? over the years, I you know, my company had worked with people like Gal Gadot. At one point, we represented Jennifer Lawrence, a lot of the supermodels, a lot of great musicians. I still work with Courtney Love on the branding side. But it's everything, right? It's like being prepared, knowing the people, networking. I spent probably the better part of almost 30 years now just going out and meeting people and trying to network. I think a lot of it is really the hustle, because probably only 20% of my business is incoming. The rest of this day is still me going out and pitching people, right? Finding like CMOs and people that are casting for jobs and pitching them. And it's a hard business. I mean, when I started One Management, I want to say there was 8 agencies. There's probably 150 now, Zach, in my space. So, and people are working out of the house, out of someone else's house. I mean, it's crazy. So, I mean, people, as I said, are getting contacted through social media and things. And everybody has 19 reps now as opposed to one. So the landscape has changed a lot. And again, probably one of the reasons why I also diversified, because I have my company still and I also do all these other things, because I think if you want to stay interested and if you don't hustle these days, you're dead in the water.
Do you ever feel like, because sometimes I feel like this, I go, well, if I fail at this thing that I'm doing, it's really not my thing because I'm a guitar player. But if I fail at being a guitar player, I go, well, that's not really my thing because I run these businesses or whatever. Do you ever wrestle with those two personalities and you go, you're calling this photographer, I mean, when you're a kid who's the biggest photographer in the world, you go, I don't give a fuck what he does because I'm a drummer. It doesn't matter. But then maybe in reverse, you go, I don't care if I fail at being a drummer because I'm a model agent or whatever. Like, do those things ever wrestle with you?
I think I'm someone that really just tries to put my all into everything, right? If you talk about the podcast, I mean, you were telling me how much research, and thank you for doing all the research. I do the same, right? I listen to like a ton of interviews. I watch documentaries on people. And every now and then people say to me, thank you for doing all that research. Because the one thing I know is that people are very thankful when you know about them, and when you don't know about them, they're offended, right? I'm sure you've interviewed people and then, you know, maybe you forgot something or you quote something wrong. It happens to all of us, right? So I think anything I do, I try and put my all into it. I mean, even when I did the tour with Courtney years ago, like, again, I had the woodshed for, I locked myself in a room for a month and just started playing because I hadn't been playing regularly for a long time. And it's nerve-wracking. I mean, literally the biggest audience I think I'd ever played to before playing with Courtney was probably a couple thousand. And then I joined her band a month later. I'm playing in front of like 20,000 people in Brazil at a festival with like the Black Eyed Peas. And I was so nervous that during the end of a couple of the last songs, I almost had to stop playing because my arms started cramping up. And I think when you don't breathe properly, you know, the oxygen doesn't flow and you start cramping. Imagine if you had a Charlie horse and you had to run a race. It was like that. And I was like, if I stop playing, I'm definitely out of the band. Although I can't really play anymore because my arm is like as stiff as a rock and I need to get through this. I know if I get through it, maybe I'll be in the band. And luckily, something happened. We walked off stage for a song or two. I was able to kind of work out my muscles and came back and finished it. And I ended up joining the band. But yeah, I mean, everything I do, Zach, probably not unlike yourself, I try and really put my all into it.
This is the greatest story, too, about how you got into the band. And you've told this story before in a handful of different podcasts.
Yeah.
But this is so unbelievable. You were hosting a 10-year anniversary party for One Management.
Yep.
And who were you originally supposed to find? Vincent Neil?
I was talking to John Five from Motley Crue the other day, and I told him I only played with Courtney because of Motley Crue in a weird way.
Because they canceled on you. Like,
yeah. Well, not the whole band. Vince Neil, the singer.
If we're going to call someone out, let's get very specific.
Yeah, I don't even want to call. Vince was supposed to, I think we flew him to New York, and then something happened. He couldn't do the show. Whatever happened. And, called my buddy up, Nur Khan, who runs a lot of the New York nightlife. He's friends with a lot of artists. So years ago, him and I put on a bunch of concerts together, and we had like Guns N' Roses play at the Rose Bar and the Black Keys and the Cult. And then he did a bunch of shows on his own and had Jack White and a bunch of great artists play at Don Hill's, Iggy Pop, the Yeah Yeah Yeahs. And so Nur knows everyone. Him and I are very connected. And we started going through the list of artists. It was my 10-year anniversary of the company I started. I'm a musician. One of my best friends who worked there managed bands, Robbie Hopman, is a guitar player. And so I thought, Robbie will play guitar, I'll play drums. I had already learned a bunch of Motley songs in the hopes that I'd be playing with Vince. And Nur's like, what about Scott Weiland? I'm like, amazing, from Stone Temple Pilots. But I said, on the solo stuff, I don't know if the fashion crowd is going to know his solo material. So went through a list, and then he said, what about Courtney? And I said, yeah, amazing. Like, what'd she do? And called her manager, and he was like, I'm not sure. But, you know, I also have other bands. I'm like, I would love Courtney to play. And I said, do you think I could play drums with her? And he's like, I have no idea. He said, we'll work it out at soundcheck. And I'm like, well, the show's like in a day or two. So do I have to learn 12 songs? You know, I didn't know. Still didn't know. So I end up like going to sound check, and I think she said to the other guys in the band, if he's terrible and he's some kind of Tommy Hilfiger fashion character.
Yeah, if he's gonna play Unplugged In or whatever. Or, I don't want any part
of
this.
I'm not coming. You know. So I played a song, and thankfully the other guys in the band said, I think that, you know, and I say this in a humble manner, that you might be as good or better than our drummer. I don't want to say I was better. But I said, I don't know, but I'm thankful that you think that's amazing. So then they called her, and then she came down. We hit her up right away. She's a fashion icon. We had a ton of mutual friends, and we played that night. It went great. I mean, it's still online. It's kind of sloppy, but I remember sitting in the bathtub like after soundcheck learning or trying to I knew a lot of the songs because lived through this, and a lot of that era of music was stuff I kind of grew up listening to in the 90s. But sat in the bathtub, woodshedded the whole record as much as I could, not knowing how I would do. Again, being pretty nervous. You know, the second time I've ever played with them would be at a concert in front of 1,000 people. And luckily, it went great. I mean, I'm sure I fucked up, and I'm sure there was things in there that, you know, that could have been better. But all in all, with like two songs rehearsing without ever playing half the songs live, like, I think I did pretty good. And so it was a proud moment for me.
Someone asked you, I think it might have been even on your podcast, but someone said, have you ever met Dave Grohl? And you were like, no, because I'm kind of in the Courtney Love camp, and the Foo Fighters is like a different camp. What do you think is the status of the camps today?
I don't really know. I mean, I think they get along. I don't know. But I, you know, I think they have a lot of love for each other. I just never know where their relationship is at. So,
yeah. I listened to your interview with David Lee Roth, which gets called out a lot.
Yeah. Sorry that you had to go through that. That was like my fourth or fifth or sixth interview. Sorry to interrupt you, but I will say that when he walked in the room, he was like, what's this interview all about? And I said, well, it's about, you know, your history, Dave, your path, your journey. He said, if you want to talk about the past, it's not your lucky day. And I was like, wow, I have like 30 pages of an hours of Van Halen research I did. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't think that was going to happen. Then we walked into the studio, and I think he saw this kind of setup, and he was kind of turned a corner, and it was great. And he was dancing and singing. But if you watch it, I didn't know what I was doing. And also, like, David Lee Roth can steamroll you on an interview. And
well, this is what I was going to ask you, because
I don't think I spoke in the whole thing.
No, but I've been in moments like this on my show where it's like people are just going. Yeah. And sometimes it's good. Sometimes it's good with Matt Pinfield. Matt Pinfield will talk and
talk
and talk.
One of my closest friends. Yeah.
I know. But it's all great. It's all fantastic.
Yeah.
When you listen back to the David Lee Roth interview, do you go, I should have just grabbed him and I just should have said, Dave, what are you doing here? Or I should have said something to have gained control of the conversation. It was unbelievable.
I don't think anybody can control David Lee Roth in an interview. I think he, when he does Stern, you know, there's a mutual respect there. I think he knew right away he could take over the conversation. And quite honestly, like I said, I didn't really have the experience, and I was only like 5 shows into it or maybe less. And so, yeah, it's hard for me to listen to now because I go back and I'm like, man, that's a rough.
Would you have handled it differently though, or what do you think you would have done if you were interviewing him now?
I just hit him up actually for a round 2 because I think like 5 years into it, I'm ready for a rematch.
And what do you think you're going to do differently, or you're going to go in knowing that if you do a round 2 and he talks like that again, it's game over, Scott.
I'm ready because
tell me, because I prepare to interview people and I want to know what you're doing. Like, what? How are you going to treat that interview differently?
You know, Zach, because you do a show now. I mean, it's you know, after 5 years, you get better, and I think I know how to handle that a little bit better now. Like, I would not let. First of all, I feel like one of the stipulations I'd have to discuss something about Van Halen. I mean, I could only really talk about his like SPF line at the time, and there wasn't a ton of new David Lee Roth music, so I didn't even know what to say because I had like strict guidelines going into it.
Yeah.
So I would make sure I could talk about, you know, what I want to talk about. Otherwise it's hard to do that. Right. I'm sure you interview people and there's like, here's the guidelines. Don't talk about this. Don't talk about that. It happens with me sometimes, you know, people are pretty cool, but you definitely get people like on almost every show that say, by the way, I don't want to talk about this. So, and I always say, look, my show's not live. So if you don't like something, we can edit it or whatever it may be. But I'm not ever there to like piss people off or say the wrong thing where they're going to, I mean, I like to promote artists and show love and hopefully they want to come back, right? If you piss people off, they're not coming back.
Yeah.
So I think I'd be ready for a rematch just because like I have more experience now at this point. And again, Howard Stern he's one of the best and has 30 years of experience. So he's ready to do whatever, right? I was like, I mean, interviewing David Roth like 3 or 4 interviews into your whatever podcasting career, not a good idea.
Yeah. How do you think you've evolved like 5 years of doing the show? What's the skill that you have developed to have gotten better at? Like, is it just the ability to be cool under pressure? Or what do you think it is that's developed over 5 years to make you ready to go back in with David Lee Roth?
I'm still pretty nervous. I mean, whenever I have a big guest on, we were talking about, I have like Jeff Garlin on. I don't know if I'll be nervous about Jeff Garlin, because the whole show of Curb Your Enthusiasm feels like my life half the time. And it's probably why it's my favorite show in the whole world. So I'm excited about it. But I feel like it's almost not normal if you don't have nerves when you do things. I read somewhere that Mick Jagger still gets nervous before he performs. I mean, every time I had a big show to play with Courtney, I always got nervous, sometimes like really nervous, right? And I think a lot of the biggest artists in the world do get nervous. But I think you figure out how to adapt and how to roll with it and how to evolve in the conversation, how to listen, right? I'm probably a better listener now. I always like learn how to self-edit on the fly, because I was telling you, I have like pages of notes, and sometimes like me and my team, Marissa, who works with me, is great, and we'll prepare these like whatever you want to call it, notes, scripts, and you know, you realize that if someone talks a lot and if someone spends 5 minutes answering a question, your 30 pages of notes is going to be one page.
Yeah.
You have to like self-edit on the fly and figure out, all right, this thing can go viral, this thing is, I have to take this out. And you have to learn how to do that and do it quickly. I didn't know how to do that early on. And those interviews I did, I remember interviewing G-Eazy. I think he gave me an hour's notice. He's like, I'm down the street. I'm like, oh, I didn't even know you were coming on. I wasn't probably great at that one, because I'm not great without any preparation. Again, we were talking about it, right? If you don't have any preparation, don't know like what someone's working on, their entire history. And sometimes you don't, because aside from my incredibly great friend, Matt Pinfield,
a lot of people don't have that brain, right? Yeah.
And God bless Matt. He's doing better now.
Yeah,
after
I was going to ask
stroke.
You, have you spoken to him?
We're very close. I was just with him for, you know, a lot of my trip to LA this last few months. He's doing way better, thankfully. But Matt is one of the few people, him and like Mark McGrath, and there's a couple people like that. Mark won like Rock and Roll Jeopardy a few times. I mean, I don't have that brain. I can retain what I can retain. My memory is getting worse the older I get. But you learn how to flow. You learn how to self-edit on the fly, and I think you learn how to carry the conversation. Someone says something, you learn how to run with that, and that can take years of like getting good at that. I'm still learning how to do that.
When are you going to have Cheap Trick on the show?
So funny, because one of my favorite bands. And so
I know.
Well,
it's Cheap
Trick,
right?
To that point, like someone had called me and said, Rick Nielsen's available tomorrow. I think one of the producers I work with. And I said, I don't want to do it if I'm not going to be good. So I'm not going to do it tomorrow. I'd love to have him on, but not tomorrow and not be good. So it's in, you know, I'm sure they're in, you know, they're definitely in the list of bands and a priority for me. And a friend of mine, I think, is managing that, I think. So, soon.
All right. Talk to me about some music. Why is Cheap Trick your favorite band? Great band, but why are they your favorite?
Yeah. One of the things I had in common with Courtney and her manager, Jonathan Daniels, who has Crush Management. He's one of the biggest managers in the world. He's got Miley Cyrus to Fall Out Boy to Green
Weezer.
Day. Weezer. Everyone. We all love like power pop. And I think Cheap Trick is one of our favorite bands. A lot of us love Oasis, right? I think it always goes back to the Beatles, right? So, I mean, if you're not a Beatles fan, you're probably not a Cheap Trick fan. Jellyfish is a band I talk about constantly.
Oh, my God. You bring up Jellyfish in, like, every interview. Every interview.
Here it is again,
you're
right?
Talking about Jellyfish. They have two albums. Yeah. To me, the first album is not perfect. The second album is closer to perfect. What do you love about this band, about Jellyfish?
Well, I just got introduced to Jason Faulkner, who was in the band on the first record and plays with Beck and St. Vincent. I said to him, is there any way we can get the band back together for an interview? I guess they don't all talk. So I don't know if that's going to be highly possible, but I am working on it because it's one of my weird goals in life. Because myself, Miles Kennedy, there are like people that come on my show and we talk about it a lot. Again, incredible pop songwriting, like pop rock, power pop, right? There's other bands that did it, like Fountains of Wayne and bands like that. But I think Cheap Trick, if you still listen to a couple of those early records, like kind of untouchable for incredible power pop with a heavy edge. And Nirvana, I think Kurt always said that Nevermind was like a souped up version of a Cheap Trick record. So again, if you want to talk about Nirvana, talk about Cheap Trick, talk about the Beatles, there's like, a through line between a lot of these artists. And so there's a reason why I love that. I mean, who doesn't love Nirvana? It's some of the best songwriting ever. So, yeah, I mean.
But what's with the love with Jellyfish? Jellyfish gets brought up in every interview. You just love the records?
Well, they sound like a kind of this amazing. First of all, they were ahead of their time, but they sound like if you married the Beach Boys, who I like, but I don't love, Cheap Trick, the Beatles, and Queen, right? And I love Queen, who doesn't love Queen, right?
Yeah.
So I think if you put all those things in a blender, and again, that band came out at a time, I think it was right around the time of Nirvana, if I'm not mistaken, like 92, 93, 94. So you have to think about the musical landscape. It was grunge. And so they came out with these incredible like five-part harmonies and all these things. And I think it just kind of went over people's heads.
Why do you think they were ahead of their time? This, to me, is always interesting because to me, the second record, Spill Milk, sounds like Beatles, Queen, the harmonies, and the record was sort of put out at a weird time where they were in between hair metal and grunge, so they were sort of in no man's land. But to me, the record sounds vintage. To me, what do you think it makes it sound ahead of its time?
Just because they're, I mean, those records to me still sound modern. I mean, it sounds
that
vintage
I agree
to you.
With. I would, well, they sound vintage inspired, but they do sound, they yeah, sound modern.
The first record especially has a 60s element for sure. A lot of those kind of, yeah, I mean, if you listen to like, I'm sure they were heavily influenced by that 60s sound, but the second record in particular, listen to the production. It might be Roy Thomas Baker who did Queen. I'm not positive.
Yeah.
So I don't want to quote that, but if it is, he did Queen, and obviously like, listen to the production. It's insane. Like it sounds like, parts of it sounds like H.R. Puffin stuff and like cartoons from like, you know, the 70s and 80s, which is so weird. But Roger Manning had this really great sensibility where he had this sort of cartoon-like thing. And so, I don't know, it's just, and it's an eclectic mix of artists. But I think the reason why people are so passionate about that band, it's like one of those, like, I always ask people like your top five underrated artists. So
yes,
they're an underrated artist to me.
They are, yeah. Do you ever listen to Toy Matinee? Did you ever listen to the Toy Matinee album? It's one album.
Is that the name of the band?
That's the name of the band and the album.
I feel like I've heard it, but I can't
always
say
loop
that.
Them in that category. It's okay. Very progressive.
Right.
It's always on my list of underrated.
I'll go back
bands
and listen
under,
to it.
If you want to. Yeah. I don't know. But it is a great record. I'm just trying to figure out what you love about those two
power
albums.
Power Pop.
The Power Pop. Pop.
Listen
to
Nirvana. It's Power Pop, right? I think Nevermind is a great example of, by the way, listen to Chad and then listen to Dave. I mean, Dave elevated that band beyond belief. I mean, the first record without Dave is a great record, but when Dave got in the band, it took on a whole nother. I mean, talk about like bands that change when they get great drummers. Think about how elevated that. And Butch Vig came in, and you know, obviously the record is highly produced.
Record Bleach. There were how many drummers were on that album? It wasn't.
I think it was just Chad, but the record wasn't produced. I mean, I think I've always heard that Kurt didn't love the production of Nevermind compared to the Steve Albini record. Because of the fact that like it was so produced. But again, I mean, there's so many like Beatles and if you want to call it Cheap Trick references, and I think Kurt had references as a Cheap Trick record at some point. So I don't think I'm like totally out of line to say that. I love great songwriting. What's the difference of a band that has a career for 40 years, you know, versus not like songs, right? So you have artists on that like, I don't know, the other day, like Rick Springfield was on my show. He's had like 5-6 hits. He's a great artist, but people know Rick Springfield from Jesse's Girl, and he's been touring for like 40 years and he's made a ton of money, right? So if you have like timeless songs, people can tour forever. And if the difference of bands that like never make it to me are songs that don't hit it because they don't have the songwriting.
Yeah. Don't you think it's so, to me, when you talk about the best underrated bands, I feel like it's so rare to find some secret underrated band that's really great, because I think most of the great stuff gets discovered and people know about it. Isn't it so rare to find an underrated band that actually has great songs and great production and really never got discovered?
Yeah, but it's weird. I mean, talk about the discovery process act in music right now, right? And you talk about like people discover music through TikTok and people discover music very rarely, like, you know, I don't know. I feel like sometimes your friends say to you, check out this artist, right? Somebody can send you something. But we live in a weird world where everyone's kind of like discovering music on these like in these like 8-second intervals on TikTok. I don't like it. And next song. And like records were made years ago to be played through and through. You didn't skip. You know, you just put the record on, you let it play. And I feel like, you know, a lot of stuff that's great does get out there, but it's so hard to make it in music these days. So that's probably the difference, right? Years ago, if records were incredible, there were a lot of amazing artists that made it. Now you're inundated with music. Everyone and their mother has a SoundCloud. Everyone and their mother has a podcast. I mean, I meet so many people. I have a podcast. I'm like, who doesn't have a podcast? So sometimes I'm like, am I doing the right thing? Because there's like 5 million podcasts now. The fact that people think my show, you know, and I'm so thankful, like one of the better music shows, I'm incredibly grateful, because when you think about the sheer volume of things and artists out there trying to make it, right? There's like millions of artists like on Spotify and YouTube. And you're like, how does anyone see the light of day with music? So I think it's harder now to make it for sure. Because back then, You had to buy a record. You had to get in a room and play music, and you had to go out there and play clubs to make it. There's bands now that never play a gig, and all of a sudden they're like a big artist, right? Which is weird to me, but that's
right.
How it works.
Right, right. Okay. Scollops is famous for his top five lists and asking guests for their top five lists. I'm going to throw a couple at you.
Sure. And,
okay?
And you know, no, I've never done this on the other end. So
you've never,
you might have to edit the whole thing.
You can throw it back
know.
At me too, okay. Like if you panic,
yeah,
whatever.
But I might panic.
I think
know.
You're ready for this, Scott. I'm going
to start. Sometimes
off.
I show people the yeah. questions, Zach. So that's, I have
no,
to
no,
say.
That's so boring. Do you yeah. do that? Do you show people the top five lists?
Because sometimes
advance?
People like get annoyed that they didn't have time to think about it.
No.
And
no.
then sometimes I, and then when
amateurs.
I do, well, then
amateurs.
When I do that, I see people like looking at their phone and reading it, and it's usually not as good, but you know, it's a mix. Some people appreciate the heads up.
I'm giving this into your wheelhouse though, okay? These are going to be wheelhouse
I know,
questions.
I didn't know we were reversing the question, the line of questioning here, but okay.
Okay, here we go. Here we go. Scott Lipps, top five drummers for you.
Okay, well,
for
you, know,
you.
Sure. You know, I just did this with Stuart Copeland.
Yeah.
Who, by the way, is one of the best drummers ever.
Yes,
ever.
Right? Yeah.
And everyone has an opinion. So, look, whether you like it or not, John Bonham is one of the greatest drummers ever. I mean, you can play John Bonham, but you're not going to sound like John Bonham. And so, you know, no question to me. I think what you want. But for me, he's always going to occupy, like, number one, because for what I like, and this is my list, so if you don't like it, it's okay.
Get lost.
Yeah. It's okay. I love John Bonham. I think he's one of the greatest drummers ever. I'm probably going to put Stuart Copeland in that list there just because, like, so innovative. His hi-hat work was incredible. And again, he did something new where he kind of inverted the beat based on reggae and dubstep and things like that. So, you know, there's, like, no one in a lot of the Please songs. And, you know, I
Spirits
could see—
of the material
yeah,
world.
You see, like, Sting turning around and yelling at him and have these videos on stage. But I'm going to put him up there, and we'll call it, like, number, I don't know, you want to say number four. I didn't give you a number five yet, but just because—
Wait, you gave me Bonham? You
Bonham
gave me
is number one.
Bonham's
I'm doing this
one.
Kind of out of order.
No, that's great.
Because
that's great.
I've never really done it
no,
before.
No, that's great.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to put Stuart number four because of the fact that his hi-hat work, he was so innovative at the time. And also, you listen to Stuart Copeland, you know it's Stuart Copeland.
Yeah.
Okay? There's a guy out there now, and I'm sure I'm pronouncing his name wrong, so forgive me if I do. Elistofano. Did I pronounce his name right? Or
I don't know if I'm so familiar.
Anyway, he's one of these guys on YouTube and on TikTok, social media. The guy plays, like, the drum parts of eight people with one arm, and he's, like, the best drummer you ever
he
see.
He has one arm.
No, like, no, I'm just saying he can. He does. He's smoking a cigarette, and he's playing drums, and
okay,
it's
a
level of drumming. I always tell people, I think I've told this to, like, Stuart and other drummers that have been on my show, like, I don't even want to watch it because it either makes me want to quit or never stop practicing because it's so good.
Yeah.
And when I was growing up, you didn't have that. We didn't have YouTube to find these guys that were, like, another level, and they were so incredible, right? So definitely I'm going to put him up there for now because
I think
he's one of the better drummers for sure. You know, again, I'm going to give honorable mentions to people like Ringo and Charlie Watts, only not because they're incredible drummers and the best drummers of all time, but when I was younger, I didn't appreciate how great they were. And without that groove and without those beats and the songwriting and the parts, those songs would not have become what they become. So because I love songs and I love songwriting, I'm not going to tell you they're the best technical drummers ever, but honorable mentions to the Charlie Watts and the Ringo Starrs of the world because they are great in their own way. Who else do I love? Man, there's so many great drummers out there. So far I've got Stuart Copeland. I've got John Bonham.
We're going to combine the Ringo and Charlie Watts slot.
Honorable mentions.
Honorable mention, not even included. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone loves Neil Peart, and the way that you say his name is always questionable.
But is he one of your favorites? Does he impact you?
I'm just going to put him on that list because there's like a debate going on. I think my entire Instagram is still filled with like people debating this now in real time as we speak.
Oh, we've settled it today. He deserves to be on the list.
I mean, you gotta put him on because like, you know, whether you like when I was younger, I thought the more drums you had, the better you were. So I had that drum set and I was trying to learn moving pictures when I was a kid and I had the drum set that went around me. And then I played a gig at a high school and I brought my drum set. And this is before cell phones. So I hired a drum tech like out of the paper and they drove my drum set away and I never saw it again because I couldn't chase them. There was no cell phones. People just had like answer machines. And that's because I was trying to replicate like the Neil Peart Rush drum set when I was a kid, right? So let's put him at like number two just because. Like,
I think we've got Bonham.
Right.
Neil Peart.
Right.
Stuart Copeland, number four.
Right. Elastofno, I'm going to put as like number three.
I think you have one more if we're doing Ringo and Charlie as honorable mentions.
Right, right.
We have one more spot. No pressure, Scott, to really nail this.
Let me think about it. Because
all eyes on you. This is going to be viral on the internet.
I should know.
All eyes on you,
I mean,
you,
a lot
Scott.
Of people love Mike Portnoy. He's an incredible drummer. Mm. Again, like whether he's a guy that I listen to all the time or not, I mean, I think he's sort of occupying that space where Neil is now. He's our generation's Neil in a way. So I'll put him on the list just because he's a great technical drummer. Not what I listen to all the time. A lot of my famous drummers are just about groove. I mean, again, I could tell you guys like, oh, I forgot like one of my favorite drummers of all time, Bunny Carlos from Cheap Trick. So, I mean, let's put Mike in there because we have to. I don't know if you want to create like a 2A for me for Bunny Carlos because I forgot about him. But one of my favorite drummers of all time because his style was incredible.
Yes.
Again, if you guys want to debate technical versus groove, technical, you have Neil in there. You have Mike in there. Groove, you have Bonham in there. You have Bunny Carlos in there. Technical, you have Elastofano. I'm sure I'm saying his name wrong, so crucify me.
My one comment is that one of my top three favorite drummers ever is Charlie Watts. And I think if you watch his isolated tracks, which you can find on YouTube, it's how groovy he was. Forget the parts. He's so groovy. I can't even figure out how he's doing it.
Well, that's my argument, right?
He's unbelievable.
Because that you have people like on the internet that say, this guy can't play and he's not good. And what the fuck do you know? But listen, first of all, again, this is my list. If you don't like it, I'm okay with it because I'm also a drummer, so I have my own favorites, and I'm entitled to like who I like, and if you don't like it, it's okay. But I figured I touched upon everything there. The guys are the groove masters, and the guys
you played it very safe, Scott.
Well, I did because
it's a very safe list.
As we speak, people are still debating this on my Instagram with the Stuart Copeland video I did.
Yeah.
Because I asked him who's the best drummer to ever live, and he said Mitch Mitchell, who was a huge influence on me growing up.
Really?
Again, you have a million people that are arguing for Pert and Portnoy and all these other guys and Elastofano and some people that I don't even know. But
so hold on. How does Mitch Mitchell influence you? Because you're listening to the Hendrix records and are you transcribing what he's playing? Or how does that influence get into you?
Every song was like a drum solo, right? Like it didn't really, he's a jazz drummer. So that's the other thing, right? I mean, a lot of my other, again, I forgot, again, one of these things people always text me, I forgot so-and-so, like I forgot Jimmy Chamberlain from the Pumpkins, who's an incredible drummer, and Jimmy comes from a jazz background. So Jimmy has a jazz background, Mitch has a jazz background. A lot of those guys, the way that they approach rock is really great because it's like a fresh perspective. I never really learned how to play jazz. My uncle was a guy named Red Rodney who played with Charlie Parker. If you ever watched the movie Bird, he was the guy that was in his band, and he had a crazy past. And when I watched that movie that Clint Eastwood did years ago, I was like, wow, I didn't know all that stuff about my uncle. But I think since I was a kid, when I really got to know him, I was in my teens, and he wanted to shield me from the drugs, and he was in jail and all this crazy stuff. If you ever watched the movie, but a lot of the best drummers like come from that perspective. I mean, Stewart has like he doesn't have a rock and roll background. His background's like dubstep and reggae and a lot of Middle Eastern rhythms. Pretty interesting stuff.
So, but when you say Mitch Mitchell had such a big impact, is that just because you listened to him a lot?
Yeah, I did growing up. I definitely learned how to play. Like Fire was one of the first songs I learned how to play. My Sharona, weirdly enough, from the Knack, was one of the first songs I learned how to play.
Who drummed on that?
I don't know the drummer's name. I mean, I think Help was the first song I ever learned how to play.
Yeah.
The Beatles, right? And so, yeah, I mean, I think the best drummers pull from different genres. So, yeah, I played it safe, but I mean, you want to argue that list? You can argue it, but I feel like I touch base on a lot of things.
Okay, here we go. Moving on to our second top five list of the show.
Okay.
Do I get a second one?
I didn't know that you were turning this around on me. I really didn't. But
what do you mean? How have I turned it around on you? Here we go.
You should have prepared, Zach.
No. Scott, that was incredible. That was a great list. Okay. You nailed it.
Thanks.
Okay, second list right here. The top five most meaningful guests on the Lip Service podcast for you. So not the best guests, not the... Who for you that you have had on the show has been the most meaningful for you?
I think I had a great conversation with Adam Duritz. I think he's got a great story from the County Crows. I thought that was a great conversation. I really liked it. I feel like he doesn't do a lot of interviews, so it meant a lot to me to sit down with him and tell a story. He's a fairly shy guy. I think he lives in New York, and we have a lot of mutual friends, but we had never met before. I loved that interview. I just had on Brent from Shinedown. Now, honestly, I wouldn't say that I was a typical Shinedown fan. Their manager is a friend of mine. He definitely opened up to me. I really loved the conversation. It was very personal. A lot of these guys tell me these stories about the drug use, and some of them, like even Rick Springfield, opened up about suicide recently. It's not, you know, I don't really get that heavy on the show. And so it always means so much to me when people dig deep. And, you know, like you said, I get into the top fives and a lot of influences about their music and their journey. But, you know, I wouldn't say that I'm not trying to do Jay Shetty. Jay was on my show early on. But,
yeah.
I mean, definitely one of my stranger interviews, as you know, because we spoke about it, was David Lee Roth. So I guess it means a lot to me just from being an interesting interview for me. I'm really excited about one that hasn't happened yet, which is Jeff Garland. So I don't know if I could say that's one of my most personal interviews, but I'm excited because I love Curb. I'm looking to get Larry on the show. Larry, if you're listening, I want to get you on the show.
Let's go.
He does a lot of sports stuff. I can't talk about baseball, but I can certainly get you on the show. I loved having my buddy Anthony Kiedis on early on because I think that was a great – we have a friendship. You know, it's interesting when you interview people that you're friendly with or friends with for years versus people you don't know. I'm sure you experience the same thing, right? You could have people on your show that you have, you know, many years of history, and it's a different perspective than people you don't know. I had on the band Pierce the Veil, and they have an incredible fan base, and a lot of people said it was one of their better interviews. So I'm so grateful and thankful when people that have a rabid fan base appreciate what I'm doing, because like yourself, I put a lot of emphasis into the research, and you've obviously done a lot of research. So yeah, I mean, I think I covered all the bases there, right? I'm probably not remembering all of them because I've done like probably close to 300 now. It's interesting, right? The ones that seem to do the best for me are ones that, like, Paris Jackson doesn't do a lot of interviews. She did really well for me. Ian Asprey, one of my favorite singers in the horror from The Call Tonight, are friends. His did well. That was also a great interview just because he doesn't do a lot of press. And Ian needs to trust you. I think, you know, one of the things with me, Zach, I think I tell people right away, hey, I'm a musician. I'm not a journalist, right? So, like, if you think I'm going to, like, do something to expose you, I'm just trying to have a great conversation. Maybe dig a little deep, but also, like, to promote what you're doing and hopefully have fun and, like, have a great conversation. I think when it's conversational and it feels less like I'm looking at my notes, it's a better conversation. So I'm sure I've grown a lot. I mean, early on, I did have people like Jay Shetty on, who's really blown up, and Andrew Watt, who's won a ton of Grammys. And it is interesting to see who I've had on that's really blown up. I had Teddy Swims on, all these people, and some of them, like, you can just see the trajectory and where they've gone, you know, from Julie Fox to Teddy Swims to Andrew Watt, a good friend. And just, you know, it's interesting catching people on their way up and what they've done. And I'm always proud when I see that.
Sometimes I've had people on the show when they're going on the way up and they're nobodies, and they come on the show and we do a great interview, and then they blow up and then they don't want to come back on the show.
Isn't that annoying? It happens to me too.
Does that happen to you too?
Yes, it does.
Somebody said to me, you got to get so-and-so on the show because you were like their first interview ever, and now they're massive.
Yeah.
And I reached out to the team and I couldn't even get a response.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, I will say when you're booking the show, it's always interesting, right? Because, I mean, the better your show does, the more you get the incoming, hey, do you want so-and-so on the show?
Oh, my God. Someone pitched me someone yesterday, a good friend of mine, and I had to reject it because I was like, I don't want this person on the show. He wrote me the most scathing text message. This is like a good friend of mine.
Right.
I was like, and I thought about it in reverse. If I pitched something and my friend said no, I would just move on.
Totally.
But do you, like, people have to take it personally, right? When
yeah,
whatever
I get
happens.
I have one guy I know who's been in a band for years and they do pretty well, but he's very upset with me that I haven't had him on. But it's just, I'm trying to cover all the genres now, but I don't really love the incredibly, like, I wouldn't call it death metal, but there's, you know, there's genres that I don't really vibe with as much. So yeah, not my thing. But.
Okay, last question. We're wrapping up here.
Yeah.
Scott, what are the best tips to knowing where to be in New York on a Friday or Saturday night? For you, you get invited to things, you know what's going on, you're plugged in. For someone who's not plugged in, how do they know where to go to be at the best place in the city at the right time on a Friday night or a Saturday night? Or you say Saturday night's sometimes not the best night in New York.
No, to be honest with you, I don't think anyone knows these days because there's so many places.
Nobody knows. No. That's the takeaway.
I will say, if you want to talk about top five,
yeah.
The members clubs are where it's at now in New York. I mean, I left New York for about 3 months, and I just been in LA the last 3 months, and I got back, and there's, like, you know, 17 new places. I'm exaggerating, but, you know, there's three new members clubs, San Vicente Bungalows, SVB just opened up here, a place called People's, just opened up here when I was away. Apparently, it's a real hot spot. 22 Club just opened up. Haven't been there yet. Chez Margaux kind of was opening when I was leaving here. Another members club. haven't been there yet. So I leave New York for 2 seconds, 3 months, whatever it may be, and there's literally all these new places. There's a trend with these members clubs. Like, I don't know if they'll all exist. You know, Zero Bond is a place that you can find me at a lot. I'm kind of a creature of habit. You know, if you go to Jack's Wife Frida, if you go to Santa Bros, like on a beautiful day, like now the weather, I think the weather by next week is going to be beautiful. I mean, you'll find me at one of these two or three spots because I like what I like. I tend to go to the same places. I have a bunch of friends that own spots, like whether it be the Flower Shop or Silver Lining or Zero Bond, which I go to a lot, or Santa Bros or Jack's Wife Frida. I kind of go where I feel very welcome, Zach. So I go to those places a lot. But yeah, I mean, with so many places that are opening up, I mean, it's really hard to figure out where to go. I will say there's a crazy trend where these members clubs are sort of taking over. And I mean, one cannot belong to 19 members clubs.
Do you think that fragments the scene and is it kind of a bummer for the scene? Or what do you think?
I mean, I'd love to bring back rock and roll. Honestly, Rose Bar to me was the greatest bar in the history of New York history ever.
Yeah.
My buddy Nurkhan ran it. He's opening up a bunch of spots now. And I think you'll see this next year is opening like, I think, 5 spots. But when Nur ran Rose Bar, you would sit down and you would see Mick Jagger talking to Tommy Hilfiger, talking to like Bill Clinton, talking to, you know, I don't know, Lenny Kravitz or something. You're like, how are all these places, all these people in one place? And the amount of people that were incredible in one room and the amount of creative forces that were in one room, you'll never see that again. I don't know if that'll ever happen. Pre-cell phones, people were having fun. People weren't so hung up on like filming things and taking pictures and tweeting about it or Instagramming it or TikToking it. They were just sort of being in the moment, which I kind of miss. So I miss like rock and roll. There are a bunch of places in New York that bands are playing at. I mean, I feel like I'm one of the people that are trying to hold the flag for rock and roll in the city. We're taking my podcast live soon. And so you're going to see a mini festival that we're doing in about a month or two that's coming up. We're having a lot of bands on, some local bands, some legendary acts. Right now it's called Lip Service Live, LSL. So look out for that mini festival, one night only. And I'm really excited about that because maybe I'm going to help bring rock and roll back to New York. I wish rock and roll and music would come back in a big way. I don't know. Your guess is as good as mine. But that's what I miss. I feel like I miss people just having fun and the days of Rose Bar and, you know, the Beatrice Inn. There were some great places in New York. It's pretty fragmented. There's a lot of members clubs. I mean, San Vicente Bungalows, you go and you have to put a sticker on your phone before you can even like walk in. I mean, I don't really care about taking pictures or anywhere, but I used to do that a lot. Now I just try and live in the moment. But I think more people need to live in the moment and not and just kind of have fun, right? That'd be great to bring the fun back to New York.
Do you think there's still this sex appeal tied to old rockers or to rock and roll in general? Because now I talk to people and they go, oh, that guy's in a rock band, ew. Right. And it's like, that should be cool, right? Yeah. Like,
it's
not cool.
I mean, I think that, you know, the younger generation looks at my Instagram line, they're like, oh, you have all these like old rockers on. But listen, I still get excited if I have on, I mean, God willing, one day Mick Jagger or, you know, Ringo Starr. I do have a lot of the legendary rock bands are in the Hall of Fame. I'm super excited about it. But, you know, you have to grow up in an era where you appreciate music and you appreciate rock and roll. I mean, I don't know if people appreciate rock and music the way they used to, but you're right. You can hear that a lot, like, ew, I don't know what that is, but
yeah.
It's not ill to me. I mean, I still get excited by having incredible musicians on my show, but you're right. I don't know if that appeals to everyone. If you look at my TikTok, I mean, you know, when I have younger bands on, it's interesting to see who interacts versus having some of the iconic bands on. I'm trying to have a mix of like old and new, because I think it's important. If it's up to me, I would probably just have on the Zeppelins of the world and the Guns N' Roses of the world, whatever. But I realize I need to, you know, definitely attract a newer audience. So it is important to have on a lot of and support the younger artists. And I'd love to do that too. But in my heart, what I grew up listening to. So I can't deny that I grew up listening to Zeppelin and Cheap Trick and Guns N' Roses and Nirvana and a lot of these bands. I mean, for me, like even the period of like 90 to 95, there were so many incredible records that came out during that time period. Like sometimes you see these Instagrams, like Pearl Jam came out, Soundgarden came out, the Chili Peppers record came out, Nirvana came out. Like, I don't know if we're going to have another time period where all these incredible rock records will come out again like that. May not happen.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Scott Lips, the podcast is Lip Service. Yes. How's the relationship with Spin?
It's great.
So I mean, they
we're a couple years in.
A couple years in.
Spin Magazine presents.
And all right, does Audio Up do the show too?
No, they're not
listed on the
cover,
but
they're not anymore.
Used to work for got it. Yeah, okay, yeah. So Spin Magazine puts out the show. Lip Service, Scott Lips. It's one of the only great music podcasts out there. It really
means a lot to me.
There aren't a lot. If you think about it, like what are other great podcasts that just do the music, so you get the best guests,
I mean, listen, I think Rick Beato does a great show.
How great is Rick Beato? He's got to be on that list, too.
I definitely took a cue out of his, a page out of his book in the sense that, like, John Five was on my show recently for Motley Crue, and he played on my show. I think you have people playing your show. People are like, I don't know, already I'm at like millions of views with John Five playing on it because I think that I never did that before. I had a couple of artists play on my show early on, and actually, we're almost out of time here, but early on, I tried to have like the Melvins play on my show. And so I remember going to the studio that had never done like a live broadcast of an artist. They never recorded bands before. And I remember saying to them, hey, have you recorded bands? No, it's fine. You know? So here I am, like the Melvins are a band that like Nirvana really admired, you know, and they show up. Obviously, I don't think they've made a bazillion dollars in their life, right? I'm kind of roading for them. I'm helping them carry like the drum set in. And we set up in the little stage in the podcast studio. And the engineer comes over and she says, oh, I mic'd everything. I didn't realize that there was a vocalist. We ran out of mics. I'm like, what do you mean? Like, this isn't Joe Satriani. It's the Melvins. Like, most rock bands have a singer. She's like, well, we don't have a mic for the singer. I'm like, oh God. So they're so punk rock that we ended up recording it. And Buzz just like sang out like in the air. And it was weird. I mean, I'm sure it doesn't sound great. I think that's still up online. If you go back and listen to it, we didn't record the video of it. Sure, it doesn't sound great, but those are my early days. So I did that. I always wanted to record bands. I had other bands like during COVID play like live acoustically. It never sounded great, especially over Zoom. It sounded probably like shit. But I mean, I think I want to do more interesting things. I mean, if I have food personalities on, maybe we'll do a little cooking or do some more playing or things. I think with content these days, as you know, Zach, you got to keep it interesting. So maybe people want to listen to me, but maybe they'd rather see someone cooking on my show or play guitar or singing or whatever. So I'm trying to incorporate a little bit of that now. But you're right. Rick Beato does a great job. My buddy Matt Pinfield doesn't really do a podcast, but he's one of the legendary media personalities, as you know. But yeah, you're right. There's not a ton of them, which is why, I mean, you're doing one, you know, but there's not a lot, right? So I think that's why I've been fortunate enough to do well, because it sits in this space where there aren't a ton of people doing it. I don't know why. Again, it goes back to like people like music anymore. I don't know.
Yeah. You're Mr. New York. When you had Andrew Zimmer on, were you surprised they said the best food city, if it was Queens alone, the borough would be Queens? Isn't that what he said on his top five list?
Yeah, and that went viral because, again, people just debate this shit for hours and days and weeks and years. People are still debating it.
Yeah.
I haven't really checked out the Queens much. So to be honest with you, like, surprising to me, but he knows his stuff. Like,
we might have to take a trip over to Queens.
I'm not going to argue with Andrew Zimmer about where to eat. I mean, the guy is like Mr. Food. So, like, no, I'm not arguing with him.
Yeah.
I trust the experts to do what they do.
Exactly.
Like you asked me about drummers. I think I know what I'm talking about.
I think it was a great list.
Yeah.
Scott Lips. Has anything been unsaid? What's been unsaid?
I don't know. You did your research. Thank you for
doing
your research.
Has anything been uncovered,
unsaid? I'm excited for the show coming up in June.
This is going to be
Lip
incredible.
Service Live.
Yes.
I wish I could tell you who's going to be on the show, but we're still like pulling it all together. But you'll definitely, if you follow me on social media, my TikTok or on YouTube or, you know, on Instagram, it's everywhere. Lip Service or my name. You'll definitely see who we're going to announce soon. I'm pretty excited about that, Zach. So thank you for having me. More people should be talking about music. So thank you for doing what you do, too.
Scott, thank you for coming on to the show.
Thank you.
The podcast is Lip Service.
Yep.
You have to go listen to it if you haven't listened to it already. Some artist that you love is going to have been on the show. It's impossible that you're not going to find someone on Lip Service interested.
That is a clue, and listening. I'm telling you, you're right. One of the artists that was on the show within the last year and a half, 2 years that kind of went viral is definitely performing on the show.
I'm even just saying your podcast. Like, if you're questioning listening to the podcast, someone you love will have had a conversation with Scott.
Probably, yeah.
Guaranteed. Right. Someone you love is going to be at the live show, Scott Lips Live. It's all happening.
Lip Service Live.
Lip Service Live.
The LSL Festival.
LSL.
Yeah.
Scott, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
Absolutely. Thank you for coming
on.
We'll see you next time.
Appreciate it.